Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
It's quite funny, when I was writing the book, when friends would say, you know, what are you working on? And I said, a book about hands. My artist friends would always immediately say, oh, great, a book about art. And my psychoanalyst friends would always say, oh, great, a book about masturbation. That the association seemed so intractable. I wrote one of the chapters in the book about masturbation because it seems that this is something that's very important in terms of understanding the hand. First of all, because it kind of refutes all the grand claims made about how important the hand is, because the idea is the hand always feels itself feeling, and philosophers have made a lot of this. But in fact, isn't masturbation a counterexample? Because when people are masturbating, it's very unusual that they can feel their hand. So why do we have this sensory extinction of the hand in masturbation? And secondly, as you just pointed out, masturbation, we tend to associate it with pleasure, but the more we think about it, isn't it more to do with pain and loss? Think about the moments when people masturbate. You'll find that very, very often, these are moments when there's been some kind of disappointment, perhaps a conflict at the office, perhaps a telephone call or a letter or an email that you hoped to receive that didn't, a domestic problem, a work problem, a problem in your love life. So the more you kind of micro-analyze the context of someone starting to masturbate, I think you'll nearly always find not just arousal, but rather the fact that sexual arousal is a response to experiences of pain and loss and, in many cases, anxiety. I think the reason that so many people use the internet to access pornography and masturbate to it is because of the increase in anxiety due precisely to being on kind of constant call, constant demand through the internet.
Is the hand the visible part of the brain? Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're going to unpack that question with psychoanalyst and author Dr. Darian Leader, whose latest publication, Hands, What We Do With Them and Why, has just been published by Hamish Hamilton, where Darian writes, "It's difficult not to notice that historically, as we move beyond the cigarette in our increasing tobacco-free worlds, something has miraculously taken its place. Almost out of nowhere, mobile phones now colonise exactly the same social and bodily spaces. Some years ago, a man described a very awkward situation. He was smoking when his date leaned forward to kiss him. As the kiss became more passionate, he couldn't bring himself to extinguish the cigarette and felt an immoral oscillation between the wish to keep dragging and the wish to prolong the meeting of the lips. If this double attachment could trouble him, how common it is today to find the same situation, but where the choice is not between partner and cigarette, but partner and mobile phone." Darian goes on to argue, the mums and dads on their mobiles in the playground aren't necessarily bad parents. They are just doing what humans unremittedly do, which is to find ways through religion, craft, technology and music to be somewhere else. So, have human beings always kept their hands busy?
Hi Susan, it's Darian Leader here from London. I'm a psychoanalyst. I'm also author of a number of books. The first one was called Why Do Women Write More Letters Than They Post? Then there was Promises Lovers Make, then Freud's Footnotes, and then more recently, I've been looking at questions of depression and mourning in a book called The New Black, What is Madness?, which tries to elaborate a theory of what madness is and how one can respond to it. Strictly Bipolar, which looks at the rise of the category of bipolar disorder in recent times. And now a new book called Hands, What We Do With Them and Why.
Darian, really well done on the book. It's such a curious and stimulating read. It brings up so many different possibilities and ideas to do with hands. It's really quite extraordinary. I might throw you a big wide open question to start off with. What does holding hands signal to you? What does it mean to you?
Holding hands has signalled historically some very different things that today, in Western cultures, it could signify intimacy and friendship, belonging to a family or being in a couple. At other times, it can have indicated a more formal relation between people, either something that isn't intimate or at other historical moments, something that's very intimate. So it doesn't always mean the same thing. It's the code and gestures, the gestures of the body, especially those using hands, have always been subject to historical and geographical variations. That's one of the fascinating things I found during the research for the book. The English are always considered to be cold. They don't use their hands when they talk. They don't touch each other when they're talking. But then go back a few hundred years and people that lived on the continent were ridiculing the English because they couldn't stop hugging and kissing and touching each other. So things have really changed over time.
Yeah, it's one of the interesting things about travel is that when you get on a plane and find yourself wherever you are in the world, how we gesture with our hands in different countries and how we use our hands. It's also regionally based, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. And at the end of the 60s, a sociologist travelled to many parts of the world and looked at people conversing in coffee shops for a period of around an hour. He found that in France, couples would touch each other while talking for about 100 times in an hour during the conversation, whereas at the English coffee shops he visited, they didn't touch each other once. Now, I think things have probably changed by now, 40, 50 years later, but culturally, there are big, big differences between what we communicate via our hands and what we don't.
Do you think in some way that human progress can be measured by just looking and examining what we do with our hands?
Well, that's a very interesting point. Stephen Jay Gould once pointed out that paleontologists, when they were looking for bigger and bigger skulls that would indicate bigger and bigger brains to try and chart the process of human evolution, that they'd been barking up the wrong tree, as it were. He thought that really they should have been looking at the hands, because he argued that changes in the brain didn't precede changes in the bodily frame, but actually would have come afterwards. And so the real important changes would have come in the hands, which would then have generated changes in the brain. And this is something that philosophers and paleontologists and evolutionary theorists still disagree about today, the kind of chicken and the egg question, what came first, changes in the hand or changes in the brain? So it's a very old philosophical debate.
It's such a surprising book, Darren. And I was just wondering, what were you setting out to resolve or to understand when you started researching this book, Hans? You're a psychoanalyst, so presumably some of that was coming into it, but there's so much at play when we think of hands, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, it's an unusual topic for a psychoanalyst to reflect on, but the book came about for a very simple reason, that for several years I'd be phoned up by journalists, magazine writers and so on, asking for a quote on how the digital age had changed the way that human beings relate to each other. Were relationships more transitory, more grounded, more stable, less stable? You know, what does it mean to be on social media all day? You know, how has this changed who we are and how we relate to each other? People were asking me this question all the time, and it seemed to me that there's some very good answers to this. There are social theorists, anthropologists, psychologists who've all studied these questions and written very well about it. For me, what was really interesting was the fact that whatever changes there might be due to our digital world, what seems so strange about it is the fact that it keeps people's hands furiously busy. If you go to a playground, everyone is swiping, scrolling, texting. If you're on the train, on the bus, in a cafe, that's what people are doing. They're using their hands almost compulsively to send messages, to check, to update a Facebook page. The hands are constantly employed. And this led me to look at the history of how people have used their hands.
So essentially our hands represent power and agency, if you will, that there are tools to engage with the world, is it?
Well, one could argue exactly the opposite, that the hands have generally been seen historically as precisely that, the divine spark present within the human body. The hands are executive organs of agency. They allow us to change the world, to act on the world. They set us apart from beasts. But then, when you think about what people actually do with their hands, they fiddle, they scratch, they curl, they do all sorts of things that they don't want to do, even when, let's say you're on a dinner date or talking to someone, you're supposed to be focusing on the person you're with, and instead your hands are itching to check your Facebook page, to send a text, to check something on your phone, as if the hands have to be continually employed. So in a sense, they both carry out our will and act against our will. They have this paradoxical position in the human body of both working for us and against us.
I was interested to read that the hands are mentioned, I think it's over 2,000 times
That's
in the
right.
Old Testament. That's so surprising, and compared to any other body part.
That's right.
And I know we talk about in God's hands and that kind of idea, or whether we're being cradled and protected. It's really quite something, isn't it?
It is indeed. The hand appears with an extraordinary frequency in the Old Testament. It's there a lot in the New Testament as well. And then in biblical texts and commentaries over the years, the hand is often equated with divine agency. And even today, several medical societies around the world have a badge, a kind of logo, where you have a hand, which originally would have been the divine hand, guiding a human hand. And what's so fascinating is that today, in an era when we understand perfectly well the importance of the brain and the mind in supposedly controlling the actions of our body, people still think that the hand is the ultimate agency of control. We speak of things being in God's hands rather than in God's brain, for example.
Now, one of the aspects of the book that was particularly revealing is the idea or the concept that you talk about in relation to the autonomy addiction. And you argue the shopping addictions, sex addictions, internet addictions and porn addictions that fill the diagnostic marketplace have become seen as addictions because they are apparently not under our conscious control. But the real addiction that lies behind them is autonomy addiction, the illusion that we can be masters of ourselves. The more we buy into this, the more mood disorders there will be. Can you talk me through that? Because I'm not sure did I fully understand that.
In the contemporary language of psychiatry, of psychology, both professional and pop media, you'll find almost every week a new addiction is invented. Internet addiction, mobile phone addiction, cinema addiction, sex addiction, shopping addiction, gambling addiction. Everything becomes an addiction. Now, we can say, is this a strange new characteristic of modern society, that there's this sudden explosion of addictions? Or rather, let's think about it more carefully. When do things start to be labeled as addictions? When they are seen as no longer being under conscious control. But that implies that we ought to be able to consciously control all our behavior, which is a very, very new idea. Traditionally, historically, no one would think that human beings can be perfectly masters of themselves. And you could argue that one important aspect of religion is precisely to explain and make sense of the fact that we can't. Today, there's this increasing idea that all human life is subject to conscious control. So any behavior that we don't intend consciously, whether it's biting our nails or checking our phone or going on the internet, these things become addictions for that reason. But the real addiction behind that, I argue in the book, is an addiction to this illusory idea that we can be fully masters of ourselves. It's an addiction to the idea of autonomy.
It's such an interesting area, isn't it? Because ultimately we're shooting ourselves in the foot. We're trying to understand our world in completely the wrong way, isn't it?
Exactly. And today things have gone so far that even death is seen as a kind of mistake that people made. You know, if you're able to do it, you need to have a great diet, go to the gym a lot, exercise a lot, have calm time when you're unstressed, all the things that modern society sells us, as if everything can be subject of a conscious choice. And obviously, this ignores the majority of the world's population who are in no position to eat what they want or to relax when they want or to not work when they want or to go to the gym. And most people's lives are incredibly difficult. It's more of a question of getting through a day than being able to choose exactly what one does. But there's this cultural imperative to make life identical with a series of choices, which has the paradoxical effect of just allowing us to prolong life. So we're spending most of our lives doing things just in order to live longer.
And we're really not then being present to ourselves and where we are in the world. But it's funny, by developing choices or by perceiving that we have all these choices to make and all this sense of agency, that then we haven't really conceived really our position in the world at all, because it's all based on avoidance, really, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. And with the idea of choice, it seems in modern society, we're constantly given more and more choices. What are you going to buy in the supermarket? Which electricity or gas provider should you choose? Which TV broadband network you should use. The fact that the choices are so many of them now that it becomes more and more difficult to actually make a choice. And even once we've chosen, we then are encouraged in a few months to choose again, taking up more and more time and energy and creating more and more stress.
As a psychoanalyst, is it possible to sit still?
I don't think so. I've asked a lot of people about this, colleagues, acquaintances in the analytic world. Everyone does something when they're listening. And this is a very interesting thing, because historically, again, most of the research on how we use our hands is to do with the use of the hands in communicating, punctuating speech, emphasizing a point, trying to convey an idea to an audience. very, very little research was done on how we use our body when we listen. And I'm arguing in the book that actually the body, and in particular the hands, are crucial when we're listening. Imagine if you're on a long telephone conversation and someone is blabbing away at you, you'll find yourself doodling, doing something, picking your nails, using your hands in some way. Or if you're in a meeting or a lecture, maybe it's not the most interesting one, you're a little bit bored, you're going to be using your hands to do things. So the experience of prolonged listening always involves hand use. And I was surprised when I started to do the research on what analysts do with their hands, you find that the single most common reported activity is not, as one might imagine, taking notes, but rather knitting.
And it's funny, not all hand movements or hand gestures are sexual, sure they're not, even though they could appear to be.
No, there's a wide range of hand gestures. Many of them are conscious, but a lot of them, perhaps most of them, aren't under our conscious control. We're doing things with our hands that we're not able to predict, to control, to master. And we can see a kind of arc here where we use our hands, we occupy our hands with what I call hand technology, mobile phones, computer keyboards, pens and paper when we're doodling. This technology stops the hand from returning to the body. Take away the mobile, the computer keyboard, the pen and paper, or with children, take away their Lego or their Loom bands, and then they'll start scratching, picking, rubbing, curling hairs, all the different human activities that people do without really wanting to do. The hand, as it were, returns to the body, and hand technology defers that return.
And where can we say that that correlates to levels of anxiety and stress, I wonder? You know, when I'm, let's say, standing in the cinema queue in the evening time, or I could be sitting in a restaurant or a theatre or whatever I'm doing, see people furiously texting or fidgeting around the place. And I sometimes make these assumptions that they're a little bit tense or they're preoccupied or nervous.
Yes, that's right. I think when one examines things more closely, one finds that very often the frantic texting, scrolling and swiping that they're doing on their phones is actually not necessarily a communication with anyone in particular. They might just be typing random letters or numbers into their phones. They might not be sending a message to anyone, but it might be a way of demonstrating that one is busy, that one is important, that one has got some kind of mission, that one's got a purpose, because it's very difficult to be in a public place without the idea that one's there for a purpose. This question has been beautifully studied by the sociologist Erwin Goffman in the States. I talk about his work a lot in the book. But one of the other very interesting aspects of texting in a public place and using a mobile or a computer when you're with other people or surrounded by people is the fact that it might seem to be, in a way, impolite or strange or odd, a way of disconnecting. But the more we think about it, human life has always been about not just connecting with others, but also fundamentally about disconnecting. And doing the research for the book, I was fascinated to find that for hundreds and hundreds of years, societies have always produced objects to be used in the hands, fans, gloves, snuff boxes, cigarettes, mobile phones. And every different historical period in which these objects were omnipresent in society, people would say, why on earth can't you just be with another person? Why do you need to fiddle with your snuff box, fiddle with your gloves, have a fan in your hand all the time? As if hands have always been kept busy, and these objects have allowed us to be at a distance, to abstract oneself from the over-proximity with other people.
You have some very interesting stuff on when people are attending, or when patients are attending their doctor's clinic, and when they walk through the door and they merely are given a prescription, but they don't actually get a proper going over, as in a hand-to-hand check.
That's right.
And I laughed when I read that, but you write something that, you know, people can feel very cheated and deprived if they don't get a proper body look over with the hand, whether it's the hand on the stomach, the legs, the chest, whatever it is.
That's right.
But it makes so much sense, because we need that touch, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, the healing hand has had a long history, starting in each of our individual lives with our few hours after birth when we're cradled in our mother's hands. And that obviously will develop over the first few months and years of life in whatever form it takes with each individual person. But there'll always be physical contact. And you can argue that you can give a baby food and drink, but without some kind of touch, it won't survive.
Can I ask you a personal question?
You can try, yeah.
Do you think that weekly or monthly massage can replace either one, lack of sex, or two, prescription medication for depression?
There have actually been quite a few studies on this. And they've all had very, very positive results. You know, the massage is incredibly important. But then when you look at the people that are being studied, most of the people that can afford to have a massage have probably got a lot of other things in their life that set them apart from other people. They might have health insurance. They might be able to have a good diet. They might have time to go to the gym. So in the end, you can't really say that having a massage is going to prolong your life, make you take fewer meds. I mean, if you read that in a paper and said, okay, great, I'm going to have a massage every week, but actually you couldn't afford it, you're lying there having the benefit of the massage at the same time getting more and more stressed about the fact that you can't afford the treatment. So you have to look at the individual case. When you look at what's happening at the level of the body, everything I've read on this seems to indicate that massage is definitely beneficial and helpful. It does a lot of things. But again, set that against the individual person's history. If that person had never been touched in an affectionate way as a child, you could argue that having the massage will fill in the lack of their early childhood. But you could also see that in many cases, it does the opposite, that it will remind the person of what they lacked earlier on, and so might produce a feeling of depletion or sadness afterwards. So I think you really have to look at the individual case here.
Can I ask you about the identity of perception? You bring up Freud a number of times in Hans.
Yeah, let's start with an everyday example. When little kids, you know, maybe between 2 and 4, watch TV, they often get absolutely delighted when they see the same thing again. When they see, let's say, Thomas the Tank Engine or My Little Pony or Hello Kitty, where they see the image again, there's a surge of joy and excitement, less than actually watching the episodes, which might in fact be very boring. But the surge of excitement and joy is it recognizing the same thing again, which is, of course, the principle of how logos work in adult life, where clothes, brandings and so on show us a particular label that we're supposed to try and refine. But with children, you really see this in its purest form. The joy and the pleasure at just recognizing the same thing again. Now, take this back to our even earlier life when we're breastfeeding or feeding from the bottle in the first few months, before the kid is interested in Thomas the Tank Engine or Hello Kitty or anything like that. Freud argues that there's a difference between the search for the satisfaction of need, like hunger and thirst, and the need for the repetition of satisfaction. Now, those are two very, very different things. Let me try and explain further. It's the idea that there's a difference between satisfying a bodily need, like hunger or thirst, and trying to recreate the sensations, the pleasure sensations that were associated, that were connected with that original feeling of satisfying the need. And obviously, those two things are quite different. People who use drugs often talk about their search for the first hit, trying to refine that first moment to make a future hit identical with the first one, just as in adult life, people might always be trying to find the same high they might have got from an earlier sexual experience or from something more anodyne, like going on a nice holiday, or, to use your example, having a nice massage, trying to refine the same thing again. That's what Freud means by the identity of perception. It's the search for what's the same as before. And in general, that's almost impossible to actually satisfy. We can hardly ever refine something that matches completely an earlier experience.
Yeah, replicating any form of experience, whether it's food, sex, live music, you can't do it. But do you think that those who are more prone to that quest, do you think that they will be more prone to, let's say, alcohol abuse or drug abuse or sex addictions or whatever it is?
I don't think one can say, because the areas in which people try to refine the same can be very different. It could be through alcohol, it could be through a drug, it could be through heroin, could be through reading, it could be through an exercise. There are lots and lots of different ways in which, thankfully, people try and refine the same thing. But I think it's really important to recognize this as a basic tendency in human life.
Does anyone kiss without doing something with their hands? I loved that line, Darian. Can you talk me through it all?
I mean, why do people have to always use their hands when they have some kind of sexual encounter? And the idea of not using one's hands seems so odd, so strange, that we have to try and make sense of that in a way obvious. It's always the obvious facts that need explanation. Kissing would seem to be an oral enjoyment, the enjoyment of the mouth, but it's always associated with the hand movement. And this kind of chimes with the much broader question, why do we always have try to get satisfaction at different registers at the same time. We might be watching a movie or TV, so there's an enjoyment at the level of our eyes, what we're seeing, a vision. But at the same time, we might be eating something compulsively. We might be grazing. We might be eating popcorn or nachos or whatever it's going to be. Why isn't it enough just to either eat the nachos or the popcorn or just to watch the TV or the film? Why do human beings always try and associate two different kinds of satisfaction? That's one of the questions that runs throughout the book.
Can I ask you about your philosophy of masturbation? You write, masturbation is also widely misunderstood to be an access to pleasure. And you talk about pain and loss.
That's right. I mean, it's quite funny. When I was writing the book, when friends would say, you know, what are you working on? And I said, a book about hands. My artist friends would always immediately say, oh, great, a book about art. And my psychoanalyst friends would always say, oh, great, a book about masturbation. The association seemed so intractable. I wrote one of the chapters in the book about masturbation because it seems that this is something that's very important in terms of understanding the hand. First of all, because it kind of refutes all the grand claims made about how important the hand is, because the idea is the hand always feels itself feeling. And philosophers have made a lot of this. But in fact, isn't masturbation a counterexample? Because when people are masturbating, it's very unusual that they can feel their hand. So why do we have this sensory extinction of the hand in masturbation? And secondly, as you just pointed out, masturbation, we tend to associate it with pleasure, but the more we think about it, isn't it more to do with pain and loss? Think about the moments when people masturbate. You'll find that very, very often, these are moments when there's been some kind of disappointment, perhaps a conflict at the office, perhaps a telephone call or a letter or an email that you hoped to receive that didn't, a domestic problem, a work problem, a problem in your love life. The more you kind of microanalyze the context of someone starting to masturbate, I think you'll nearly always find not just arousal, but rather the fact that sexual arousal is a response to experiences of pain and loss and, in many cases, anxiety. I think the reason that so many people use the internet to access pornography and masturbate to it is because of the increase in anxiety due precisely to being on kind of constant call, constant demand through the internet.
So how do you think, Darian, parents should deal with their children masturbating? Do you think that they should look at some of the issues like anxiety or some of the kind of psychological background?
I mean, that's more interesting to think about if you're trying to make sense of why humans masturbate and when they do, to see it as a defense against anxiety rather than as a kind of pure access to pleasure. I think, you know, with sex, there's always something, and with bodily experiences, you know, when a child gets its first erections or its first engorgements, with all these early sexual experiences, there'll always be something alien and traumatic about them. And I don't think there's any formula or recipe that can normalize that. I think sexuality always has a dimension, a traumatic dimension to it, something unexpected, something that can't be entirely processed. And that, you know, in families, when parents encounter this, they just have to do the best they can to try to give some kind of meaning to the changes in the child's body. It's interesting, if you look at the current vogue of superhero movies, almost every month now there's a huge big-budget Hollywood movie about someone who experiences changes in their body. Spider-Man, Superman, all these superheroes are people who are surprised by what their body can do. And you can see that as a way of basically trying to process the question of what happens to boys and girls at puberty. Their body changes and they need to make sense of it.
Yeah, you've great stuff on fairy tales like Sleeping Beauty and the like, and all these funny openings that suddenly materialise.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, indeed. When Sleeping Beauty finds a hidden secret room in the castle, which no one else had known about, and then touches a spindle and blood is produced, it's very difficult not to see that as either menstrual blood or blood from the rupture of the hymen, in the secret room having an anatomical resonance.
Is it too much of a stretch to apply your pain and loss framework on pornography?
I think it's exactly the same thing. You know, again, look at the individual case. When patients talk about using pornography, it's very important to find out when and why they've used it, at what moment, what exactly was happening in the half hour, the hour, the 2 hours before that. And again, you'll always find that there's something that the person wants to stop thinking about or to avoid. that our bodies and our minds aren't easy things to live with, to cohabit with. So we're constantly trying to find ways to dull, to lessen the anxiety, the agitation, the tension that inhabit us.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with psychoanalyst and author Dr. Darian Leader on the unique place of hands in human history. Now, one of the curious aspects of Darian's latest offering, Hands, What We Do With Them and Why, is when Darian examines the complex relationship between pain, pleasure and the hands. Suffice to say, it's not straightforward. Now, Darian pitches up a very interesting question. What happens when the hands are kept from their business? Hands scratch, rub, pluck, press and pull. I asked Darian about the work of Dr. Elaine Scarry, who in 1987 wrote The Body in Pain, and what Elaine has offered the world in terms of what we understand about that, well, particularly interesting relationship.
That's an amazing book. It's such a good book that I actually haven't finished it because I find it so intensely brilliant that I read two or three pages at a time, and I think I've got about five or six left. I've been reading it for a long time. It's an amazing book, and it's very interesting, the focus at certain points on the relation of the hands to pain. And one of the arguments that she makes is she kind of shows that the way we use tools and weapons is much more complex than is traditionally thought. And a tool can become a weapon just as a weapon can become a tool. And she argues that, in a sense, what turns a tool into a weapon that we use with our hands is the nature of the surface on which it falls. Is that surface sentient or not? So if we strike another human being with a bone, we'll say the bone is a weapon. But if we use the bone to strike a lump of clay, we'd say that the bone is a tool. There's no difference in the nature of the bone or the nature of the action of striking. The difference is in the nature of the surface on which the bone is having its percussion. You can complicate that even further to say, you know, what would happen if someone's doing something like, let's say, Gestalt therapy, and they're given a cushion and told to imagine that the cushion is a person that they love or that they don't love so much. They might hit the cushion, they might cradle the cushion, but what they do with it, surely the surface of the cushion isn't a sentient surface. But if one hits the cushion with a, you know, with a, some sort of object, surely that object is a weapon rather than a tool. So it gets more and more complicated the more you think about what things stand for. When we hit some object, is it standing for another person or not?
Yeah, but you could be really frustrated and cheesed off, and you could smash something with your hands, or you could pull at something, or you could slap. And yep, there is a tremendous release and satisfaction with that. And it's not necessarily somebody who's incredibly aggressive, you know. It's a whole release that we get. And it's whether you view it as pleasure, release, I don't know what word is apt to describe it. But there is that sense, isn't there? So it is an unusual relationship.
Absolutely. But it gets even a little bit more complex when you explore what actually happens after the person has struck something. They're always striking things with their fists. There's a proverbial scene in movies where an angry or frustrated character punches a mirror or punches some kind of glass surface. Now, afterwards, the person might have their hand in bandage. And what we see over and over again is the fact that there's a certain satisfaction in having knocked the hand out of action, as if our hands are overbrimming with agitation and tension in our bodies. Hand technology gives us a way of using that, of localizing it, of operating with it. If you're constantly using a mobile or a computer keyboard in your hand, you're keeping that agitation focused, you're keeping it busy. But if you then smash your hand into a wall, there's also a kind of release, but not just of, let's say, internal psychical tension, but also of the bodily agitation inside us, the tension in the hand.
And of course, that allows you to let go well at the best of times.
Indeed, yes.
What do you think Quentin Tarantino has done to our understanding of the hand?
Yeah, I was interested in Tarantino films because people always refer to a movie or some cultural product as being Tarantino-style or Tarantino-esque. When there's strange meandering conversation, people talk about the details of hamburger preparation and then they move on to questions of existence and mortality, life and so on, as if this is the hallmark of Tarantino. But for me, he's doing something very, very precise in his films. In every single one of his films, there's a scene or several scenes when people are talking in this meandering way, usually given this adjective Tarantino-esque, but what the language is there for is just to ward off the moment of death. When John Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson meet the youngsters who've stolen their boss's gold in Pulp Fiction, they have a chatty conversation with them, but we all know that it's going to end in people being killed, just as at the beginning of Inglourious Basterds, the moment when Christoph Waltz is grilling the French farmer about the whereabouts of people who are hiding. We know that this nice, polite, genteel conversation will probably end in an act of violence. So what he's doing is showing that all speech does is ward off the moment of death.
He's an amazing power in terms of mood as a film director and producer in how he executes all of that. But his particular fascination with the hand and whether it's chopping fingers off or the fist and brutal violence with the fist, like killing with your bare hands. Really is, it's pretty primitive stuff. It's mind-blowing really, isn't it?
I think his films are very different. For me, what he's really a master of is exploring our relation to mortality, that it's not about dying, it's about the knowledge of dying. It's playing on the fact that we know we're going to die, something that people tend in general not to want to think about or recognize in any way. Indeed, you know, we probably spend most of our lives trying to forget that fact. But he relentlessly brings it back. The acts of violence, when they come, always come after moments of unbearable tension. Sometimes they involve the hand, sometimes they don't. But for me, what characterizes the films is the particular relation of language to time and death that he orchestrates.
What you make of hand reading is a matter of interest. It's not something that you develop in the book, but, you know, through the years, so many of my friends have been obsessed with going and getting their hands read, whether they've been in India or in Africa or wherever they've been, you know. Do you think it's a lot of toss, basically?
I think what's interesting about it is that it's part of a range of practices which imply that our body is the bearer of a knowledge that we don't have access to, that a professional, someone who knows about these things, can read our palms and then tell us. So it's the idea, you know, just like with a dream, you have a dream, it's your dream, just like your palm is your palm, it's part of your body, part of yourself. But we don't know what the dream or the palm means until someone else tells us. So it's about, again, our relation to knowledge. People like the idea that someone else knows more about themselves than they do. And I remember many years ago, people were horrified at the rumor that Ronald Reagan consulted an astrologist. In fact, for me, that was a very, very positive thing. It's much better if someone in charge of a big country goes to see an astrologist, because it implies that they don't think that they know everything themselves, that they realize there's a knowledge beyond them. Things get much more difficult if the person thinks that knowledge stops with them, that they are the law, they are the creator of everything that happens in, you know, in their legislature. So that's something which, for me, is much more dangerous than the idea that someone else knows more than them. It's a whole contemporary culture, you could say, of experts. Palm readers aren't so common today as they once were, but there are lots and lots of new experts that have taken their place. Life coaches, you know, people that will tell us about ourselves.
But Darian, a lot of people would have seen Reagan's particular fascination with palmistry and astrology and all that as weakness and vulnerability, and that it didn't represent strength and leadership, that he was in some way looking for other options.
But isn't that a good thing? Isn't vulnerability in a leader better than the absence of vulnerability?
And the absence of naivety. Can I ask you, you've covered so many different angles in the book. There's cultural, economic, social, there's so many different aspects. What confused you the most and what shocked you the most?
Doing the research for the book, which took a number of years, what struck me the most, what surprised and amazed me the most, was seeing how far back hand technology goes, how far back people have had things compulsively in their hands all the time. Things like fans, for example, they weren't used to create a current of cold air like they are today. They were constantly held in the hands, you know, all the time, and used as part of speech to punctuate a sentence, to emphasize a point, and so on. They were literally inseparable from people's hands. And at the same time, commentators would say, why on earth do people constantly have to have something in their hands? So for me, the most, you know, surprising part of the research was this discovery that hand technology has a long history. And also, people have always complained about it. They've always been things that people have kept their hands busy with, and they've always been complaints about, why do you need this silly stuff? Now, the more you think about it, it shows that there might be a necessity to mobiles, to cigarettes, to fans, to snuff boxes, as a way of allowing ourselves to abstract ourselves, to disconnect from the over-proximity of other people, to escape from the situations that we are in every day of our lives.
So keeping our hands busy essentially is, I suppose, fundamental to human activity in every
absolutely.
Aspect.
Absolutely. And I think that that's why all these visions of the future and some of the technology efforts today to produce hands-free technology are doomed to failure, because people want to use their hands. The idea of having a hands-free car, people are doing it not because there's anything very interesting about a hands-free car, but because you're not allowed to use your mobile while driving in most countries. So it gives people a way to hold onto their phones rather than a steering wheel.
So last question, and it's something that baffled me when I started reading your book. We actually do daydream with our hands, isn't that it?
I think we do, yes. Constantly using our hands with language, with our thoughts, with the imagination. The hands are always there. And it's a total fantasy to think that language, speech, thought can be disembodied, can be abstracted totally from the body. The body and hands are part of language, part of the aspect of our lives, of our experience.
Psychoanalyst and author Dr. Darian Leader. Hands, What We Do With Them and Why is published by Hamish Hamilton and retails for just under €14 in hardback or €12 on a Kindle. Now, I know it's early days yet, but if you're short for an idea on what to buy a loved one at Christmas, well, trust me in this one, Hands should certainly do the business. Now, before I go, I've a handy little competition for you from the good people at Books Ireland. All you have to do is answer this fairly straightforward question, and the first correct answer past the post receives an annual subscription to Books Ireland. So here's the question. What famous American singer-songwriter was recently awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature? And yes, you would have to be living on planet I don't know what to not figure out that one. The first correct answer to talkingbooks@newstalk.com gets an annual subscription to Books Ireland. Best of luck. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Ronan Brannock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been Talking Books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with some surprising insights from Dr. Darian Leader from Hands, What We Do With Them and Why. If you are surprised and delighted to be contacted out of the blue, usually in the early evening or late at night, it may signal less an authentic outpouring of love or a reaching out to a true companion than a desperate attempt to find one more person to send a message to. Consoling words indeed. Good night.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.